Dr. Taylor, for a while, like, we really appreciate what you guys do. We were talking about a space that you were in last year. I think it was a bank holiday, and you joined so late, and you were on here for hours, and it was like well past midnight, and I could tell you were knackered and you wanted to go to bed, but you kept answering questions, and we just wanted to say thanks. I don't want to put you on the spot, by the way, to speak. I just wanted to get that in because sandwiches are waiting.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, Aaron. Can you hear me now? I'm having a bit of a problem with my phone.
No, you're good.
Yeah, I thought I picked up your message today that you sent me about popping up to Edinburgh for the leaflet thing on the 15th.
I was feeling a bit brave. And...
Well, I don't know if I can do that or not, because I've got the four kids and it's a bit of a way to come. But anyway, I thought I'd just pop on today, and if I can, I will. But I'm not sure if I can yet. But I thought I'd just pop on today and say hi, basically, because I hadn't spoken to you for a while, and you'd mentioned about coming in and saying hello. So and if there's anything you want to ask me, there's a lot going on at the moment where I feel that patients with chronic diseases are being swept under the rug, and there's a lot of us that just aren't prepared to let that happen. And whether we're successful or not, I have no idea, but we're not going to give up because it's not right.
Dr. Duncan, I'm not sure if Aaron's off making sandwiches, but you almost ignited a pride of Scotland versus pride of Australia, of the medical practitioners fighting for people with long COVID. And he claims Scotland's the best because you and Dr. Taylor, and I tend to claim that Joff is right up there with you guys as well.
Oh, Joffy?
Yeah, Dr. Joffy, yeah.
Oh, well, Dave and I, obviously, we work together in the WIN, but you can kind of, I like to claim Scotland and Australia because I used to live in Australia for a while as well. So it's like my second, third home. Technically my third home because I live in England now, but...
How are things going over there? I was very disappointed to see that Dr. Taylor's been receiving so much pushback with some of the things she's doing trying to help patients. And I was wondering, in the cardiology field, do you think that there's a wider acceptance of some of the phenomena that have been noticed in the past few years? Or is there still that strong pushback?
I have to be quite careful what I'm able to say publicly. I think there needs to be some... I think we need to get to a stage where we actually have some training guidelines for medical staff. But I am beginning to notice a bit of a change. So like Benita Kane and I are going to speak to... We've been asked to present to... a whole group of nurses who are organising a webinar because they want to learn some stuff about it. So that's really nice. So we're going to go and talk about more about the medical side, you know, the actual practical side. There's some stuff we're doing through the WHN that we hope will help. I can't really talk about it any more than that yet because it's not ready for publication. It's going to be a while. But we're on to another project. We've actually got about three or four projects going on with WIN at the moment. So there's quite a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, but it's just, you know, it's the usual story. It's just, it's not enough. And you know, from a patient perspective, I know there's a lot of patients very upset in the UK at the moment because they've heard that some of the long COVID clinics that we have are possibly going to be closed or might be being defunded. But I think what I want to say really is that there have been, not just us, but a lot of doctors really trying to fight for them. It's not the doctors shutting them, it's to do with commissioning. And that's out with our remit, unfortunately. And I have had colleagues fight very, very, very hard to try and keep, clinics running and funded and, joining with patients and advocates to try and get this going. But yeah, it doesn't really make sense to me. Long COVID numbers are continuing to rise, which means dysautonomia is continuing to rise, which means ME/CFS is continuing to rise. And really, there's, in this whole narrative that there's nothing you can do, there's no treatment, it's just not true. I mean, there's no cure, but there can be treatments for part of it already, because we're treating it. It's just about it's about recognizing it. And I think the difficulty that I see now, I'm seeing, it's kind of like the perfect storm in a way, because so many people are not testing anymore that they don't know whether they've got COVID, because the acute index infection for a lot of people is I hate the word mild because it's not mild, but the acute index infection isn't as severe as it was at the beginning for a lot of people. It still is for some people. It's not the acute index infection, it's the long tail stuff that's causing the down the line issues. And a lot of people don't seem to be joining the dots that this cough, cold, flu-like symptoms they had a month ago are the reason they're now getting, chest pain or racing heart rates, or they feel exhausted, or they faint when they stand up too quickly and try and stay standing up. They're not making these connections because the education's not there. It's just not there. And so I'm seeing patients who don't even know they've got long COVID, and I'm saying, I think this is long COVID. And they're like, well, I haven't had COVID. Well, did you have a respiratory illness recently?
I
Yes.
think that they don't want to believe that they have it.
Yeah, and did you test? No. Well, how do you know it's not long COVID then if you don't know whether you've had COVID or not? Well, I'm sure it wasn't COVID. Why? What makes you think that? Well, it was just the summer flu, and I'm like, well, you don't really get flu in the summer. So there wasn't much flu circulating at that time. So I'm seeing this quite a lot, and then the issues, other people are saying, well, there's no biomarker, there's no way of diagnosing it. There's quite a lot of abnormalities you can see in blood tests if you know what you're looking for. And I see patterns all the time, and I think when you've seen enough patients, you see very, very clear patterns of disease. And you know how to, you kind of know how to manage it. You don't have a cure, but there's lots of things that can be done. And I think,
Doc, is that based on a different clinical presentation to the sorts of things you were seeing pre-pandemic? Is that your experience pre and post juxtaposed in order for you to make a reasonable inference that it could be COVID related?
Oh, pre-pandemic, I was predominantly a, well, I was a cardiologist. I wasn't really seeing post-viral disease at all, really. I've had to learn a completely new medical specialty very quickly. So it's been a, yeah, it's been a very steep learning curve for me. So, but yeah, there's so it's so obvious when you've seen enough patients, you know what you're looking at, and there's very, very obvious phenotypes. So, long COVID is an umbrella. Long COVID is an umbrella condition, which is actually an umbrella term for lots of chronic issues that are being triggered by COVID. So obviously, about 50% will meet diagnostic criteria for ME/CSF, and post-exertional malaise is clearly one of the hallmarks, along with fatigue for that. Quite often we're seeing people with abnormal, venous blood gas, PSVO2s and lactate levels. So that's something that can be useful if you suspect it and you see that sort of pattern. This is not, published on this, is just my own kind of clinical acumen. But then, there's a very clear pattern of those with, histamine and mast cell issues. And it's so obvious when you see it clearly. They had no issues beforehand. They weren't allergic to anything. And then now they're reacting to all sorts of medications and food, and alcohol's a classic one, you know, flushing and, you know, getting crampy abdominal pains and hives and all that kind of stuff. You know, and just helping in conjunction with the Canadian consensus guideline statements by giving, you know, antihistamines, but it's, they're off label. You have to have informed consent from your patient. You have to tell them all of this. Even though we've got guidelines, they're not based on large randomized control trial data. It's smaller studies. And then dysautonomia is another massive one. Massive one. And the amount of people that get misdiagnosed with anxiety, when if you just stand them up, just stand them up for 10 minutes and measure their heart rate and blood pressure, and you know, you can very clearly see what's going on there, and we've got treatments for that. We haven't got a cure, but we have got treatments. But
you still do transcranial Doppler testing, looking at cerebral blood flow. Is that something you still offer?
We managed to do that. So we've managed to do that on a few cases where we've been writing things up, you know, for research. We can't do that in the general clinic because we haven't got the funding. So it's all to do about funding, commissioning, etc. So can't do that in, you know, every day. But if it's funded through the research, then we have got that. But yeah, we did do a case and we saw very clearly that, and possibly not surprisingly, that the, you know, the blood flow in the middle cerebral artery was dropping on standing, which is probably why some people don't feel very well when they stand up. And they get orthostatic intolerance, and their brain fog gets worse. So, you know, it's a very, very complicated condition, but it's actually not that complicated when you understand the pathophysiology. And we're still learning about it. We don't know everything about it, but you know, the thing that I'm seeing, I think, with long COVID that I don't think is as obvious with those who've developed CSF from other viruses is the vascular side. I think COVID seems to be a very, very vascular virus. And yeah, because when you think of long COVID, you don't think of heart attacks and strokes, but that's the bit I try and, you know, push to people who are making policy decisions. You know, it's harder to dismiss things that people understand, like heart attacks and strokes. Fatigue sounds vague, but it's not vague. It's not, fatigue's a terrible word actually, because it doesn't describe how awful it is to feel like you've been poisoned, because that's kind of what people with long COVID and ME feel like. I mean, I guess I've been seeing people since 2020 with it, and there's no way this amount of people have the same symptoms from all over the world who don't know each other after being infected by a virus. There's no way this is psychological. It's just not. It's just completely not.
On that topic of psychological, as far as phenotypes go, from my understanding of some research out of the States, they were looking at one which was more a neurological phenotype of long COVID, driven a lot by dysautonomia and potential neuroinflammation. Is that something that, as well as sort of the vascular side of things, and I know there's crossover to it, are those predictions of greater rates of Parkinson's, for instance, something that concern you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, when I got into this because I was sent to work in a COVID ward and I was seeing things I didn't like, and then I was seeing patients with racing heart rates, young people being admitted through A&E with racing heart rates, sinus tachycardia, so it wasn't a rhythm problem, you know, and they were lying there, you know, the heart rate's 140 and they're chatting away, and then you ask them to sit forward and their heart rate's shooting up to 190, and I'd never seen anything like it in my life. And you know, other doctors saying, well, you know, it's not an emergency, they're kind of well with it, we're going to have to discharge them, because the middle of the pandemic and we've got to make space for those that are need immediate medical intervention. And you know, I remember sending around an email saying, if anybody sees these individuals with these findings on TEEK, please could you can you let me know? Can you refer them on to me? Because somebody needs to be following them up. We need to find out what's going on, because this is not normal. So that's how I kind of got into the side and looking at the vascular side. But the more I've learned about my about the neurological side, which is completely not my area of expertise, I almost think the neuro side almost worries me more than the cardiovascular side. Danielle Beckman, I don't know if you guys know her. She's an absolute brilliant neuroscientist from the States. But she's joined Wynn, and she gave us all a fantastic presentation recently about, with pictures of the damage this virus is doing to our brains. And it's just something that's not being talked about enough. It really
Can I ask you, Dr. Duncan, real quick, while you're on that? I know you're not a neurologist, but I have a neurologist appointment, actually, finally, for the first time on Thursday. Would there be anything that you could suggest of like three basic questions to ask them? Because they do understand long COVID. I briefed them ahead of time and like made sure I'm not just going to waste my time. At all. Like, if you don't, that's also fine. And I can try to contact, as you just said, Danielle Beckman. But I was just curious if you might have an idea.
Well, I mean, I think there is my understanding of the neurology, I have to be really honest here, compared to somebody like Danny, it's really rudimentary because I'm not a neurologist. But there, what's been seen in the research is, there appears to be a link between vascular inflammation and neuroinflammation in the brain and disruption of the blood-brain barrier, which would fit, because if you've got a single endothelial basement layer in your capillaries and a basement membrane, and you've got an endothelial layer and a basement membrane, then you're straight into brain tissue. Then if that blood-brain barrier gets disrupted by, you know, a virus that makes it leaky and you get inflammatory molecules leaking through a disrupted blood-brain barrier, then you're going to get issues in the brain. And obviously there's been some research showing, you know, spike protein accumulation in the meninges of the brain. Danielle has been doing some fantastic work, that some of which isn't published yet, so I can't really talk about it much more, but I'm sure when it is, she'd be happy to, and she'd be able to explain it a lot better than I can. But from a clinical perspective, as somebody seeing patients, I mean, the main thing I think is the big symptoms for me are dysautonomia, severe skull crushing headaches, and brain fog's not, it's such a minimizing term, brain fog. Brain fog is actually cognitive dysfunction, and what we tend to be seeing is a very specific pattern of dysexecutive syndrome. So it's the higher executive functioning, so it's you're able to process, the ability to process things, processing, but also things like sensory overload, you know, noise intolerance, light intolerance, concentration, being able to read a document and take it in, whereas you would have just skipped through it before, but having to reread it or read it, or somebody trying to talk to you and realizing that you don't understand what they're saying and you have to get them to repeat it, as well as obviously the memory issues, you know, forgetting words, forgetting names of people you've known for 30 years. It's now, again, I think there does need to be a lot more research on this, but from my perspective, one of the big things that I'm always advocating for is prevention, because even for people who have already got long COVID and ME, we don't want anybody catching this again and again and again and again and again, because, you know, we know it's doing damage.
It's certainly something I've got to face, having gotten sick and then gotten better, and that cycle's happened a number of times for me now. I think I'm going to be either masked up to the wazoo or a hermit for the rest of my life, because I just can't afford it to keep happening. I'm sure other people feel the same. There's a few hands up, Doctor. Do you mind if I ask perhaps if you might be able to listen to Defreeze Doug and then Kevy yourself, your second? I feel a bit bad making it a Q&A, but I know that your opinions are very much respected in the community.
happy as long as nobody asks me anything medical questions. I'm not allowed to give out any medical advice over the internet, but as long as it's not that, then.
I kind of wish everyone followed that set of ethics, but Doug, I saw you had your hand up, mate.
Yeah, man. Dr. Duncan, I do have a question, but it's not advice or anything I'm asking for. It's just a more of a hypothesis. What do you, by definition, do you think it's possible that a lot of people have actually been infected with encephalitis on top of their COVID infections? How much do you know about that particular theory and thought process? Based off, again, if it's just based off inflammation of the brain.
Well, encephalitis, all encephalitis means is inflammation of the brain. Whereas meningitis is inflammation of the meninges. It's more a descriptive term. So it's another way of saying neuroinflammation, but specifically in the brain. And I think it's already been demonstrated that you can get inflammation in the brain, and it's been seen on PET scans.
No, I guess I didn't word that well. Do you think that it's being underdiagnosed as a whole? Like, do you think that there's people with long COVID that had encephalitis that may or may not have even known it? I got diagnosed with encephalitis is the reason I'm even asking.
It's difficult. I wouldn't like to speculate because it's not my area of expertise. I think it's possible. I think it's possible. But the difficulty with long COVID is the changes that we see on the standard scans are either absent or subtle, because the standard tests we do are not right. They're not the right tests. There's a lot of findings in the research setting that don't translate to clinical medicine yet, because the tests, it's kind of like if you think about, just using an example, if you think about multiple sclerosis, for example, completely different disease, nothing to do with COVID. But MS, for years, people didn't know what caused it. Some people were dismissed, gaslighted, thought they were, it was all in their head, and obviously it was all in their head, but it was an organic thing in their head, not a mental health issue. And it wasn't until we developed the test that showed demyelination that then the things moved forward, and patients could get diagnosed, patients could get a diagnosis, they could get treatment, they could get to see a neurologist, people started learning more about it. And I think part of the issue with post-viral disease is, one, it's been massively underfunded, the research, for decades. And I do generally think if the research into ME had been much better than it had been, we would have been in a lot better position now when we have a viral pandemic hitting and loads of people are getting long COVID and 50% of them are developing ME. And that's a we've dropped the ball massively. And I think anybody that tries to sweep a mass disabling event globally under the rug now is also dropping the ball, because we need to be learning, and we need to be learning quickly, and we need funding for research, and we need to have, specialist clinics. We need to actually get together, not just the UK and the US and Canada, but just need to get everybody who's working in this field together. It doesn't matter what country you're in. And if you've got expertise in doing the brain, you research the brain stuff. If you've got expertise in the heart, you do the heart stuff. If you've got expertise in mitochondria, you do the mitochondrial and the energy stuff. But it just needs to happen. And once we've got that better, then we really need to be moving into treatment trials now. It's been 5 years. 5 years. We start needing some big treatment trials, because that's the way we actually get treatments into clinical practice.
Dr. Duncan, I'm probably stating the obvious here, but while there are some research grade techniques for imaging like high resolution 7 Tesla MRI machines and other things like cerebral blood flow measurements and things like that. There are tests that could be standard practice in a diagnostic environment, but there's no sort of standard procedure or recommendations for medical practitioners to use that testing at present, is there? There's no sort of overarching organization setting the standards for treatment along COVID globally.
That's a major problem. What we actually need is an international, we need post-viral disease to be an independent medical specialty. And once you have that, that's when you get your guidelines. Because, for example, you know, the standard guidelines for cardiology, obviously I'm going to use cardiology as an example, is, you know, we have the European Society of Cardiology, and then we have the AHA, the American Heart Association, and, you know, the American ASC, the American Society of Cardiology, and they've got the Canadian one, and then you've got the Australian one. And what tends to happen is when they write international guidelines, the Europeans and the Americans get together and they form the basis of the guidelines because they've got the biggest groups. But then they get, you know, input from the other countries and they endorse them, and it will say, you know, joint AHA ESC guidelines in cardiovascular medicine for the investigation, treatment, managing and follow-up of valvular heart disease. And everybody signs off on it. And then it says, also endorsed by the Canadian Society of Cardiology and the blah, blah Society of Cardiology, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just, it's accepted, but it's accepted because everybody understands the level of evidence. So your level of evidence is, you have this kind of A, B, C, D level of evidence. A is your top, which is your multi-center, multi-country, multinational randomized controlled trials. That's kind of your gold standard. Without a shadow of a doubt, you've got loads of them looking at millions of patients, and it's a no-brainer. This is what happens. This is what you treat it. This is how it works, and this is what you should be doing. And then you've got your kind of grades, which is a 1A, 2 split into 2A, 2B, and then 3. So a 1's you should do it. A 2A is you should probably at least think about doing it in certain situations. 2B is you should probably not think about doing it in certain situations. And a 3 is definitely don't do this because it makes people worse. And that's how it's all graded. And I think what we really need is we need to have a post-viral disease, probably international post-viral disease medical specialty, where we, but to do that, we have to have the level of evidence. But you can still do guidelines without that high level of evidence, but you have to make it very clear that they're based on small trials with expert consensus opinion, and the level of evidence is only a level C or a D or what have you, because patients need to know that. And I think the difficulty now is so many medics, if they've not been trained in a particular field, if you haven't got guidelines to follow, if there's not evidence-based practice, they're scared to give medication that is off-label because, one, they're not confident in doing it, two, they're worried about legal ramifications. And so, you know, it's this whole at first do no harm. But I think from my perspective, and I'm not suggesting there's lots of drugs that we definitely shouldn't be giving without treating them at all, but, you know, things like dysautonomia, the medicines that have been used for dysautonomia have been used for decades. They're all licensed medications. They are technically being used off-label, so you do have to tell the patients this. And it's not an ideal situation, and it would be better if we had funding for research to do the trials to show which ones work best in which situation. But we're also in the middle of an ongoing global viral pandemic where there's 400 million people disabled, and to do nothing is doing immeasurable harm.
It seems like common sense, but it doesn't necessarily seem the way the system works presently. I'm conscious I don't want to take up too much of your time, Dr. Duncan, but I did see Kevy's still has his hand up. Thank you for your patience, Kevy, and also I saw Sean jumped on as speaker. I'm not sure if he had a question too, but Kevin.
Thanks. I was just wondering, Dr. Ray, are you NHS?
Yes.
Right.
Thanks, Kevin.
Ask one more question.
I'll just let Sean ask his, just so, because I know he's jumped up with one too. But if you, thanks, mate. But I really hope that you're able to sort with your GP, perhaps a referral, or at least to try to attempt to, because I know that you've been struggling with certain things like that for quite a long time that you've mentioned before. And it's so nice to have someone to come up and answer some questions. It's really quite special. I really appreciate it, Dr. Duncan. Sean, and then Livin Gase, if there's time.
Yeah, my question isn't anything too interesting. I was just wondering, like, speaking from a cardiologist point of view, do you feel that, I know you can't speak for other people, but do you feel that dysautonomia and autonomic failure is undersold a bit? Like, from my personal experience, I've always felt that, like, it's something they just associate with elderly people, and maybe, I mean, obviously they do have the knowledge, but I don't think that maybe some clinicians understand, like, how disabling it is.
Yeah, the difficulty is, and again, this is where it comes down to clearly defined job roles, because POTS doesn't automatically sit in cardiology. It never has, not in the UK anyway. It might do in other countries. So certainly we have a falls and syncope service in my hospital, but it's not run by the cardiologists. It's run by autonomic nervous system specialists, who, some of whom also work in care of the elderly. I ended up seeing a lot of POTS patients because obviously I was getting involved in the long COVID, you know, cardiovascular side of things. So I've just kept doing that. But, and again, it comes down to the whole difficulty, because post-viral disease is not yet recognised as a single medical specialty on its own. It's kind of falling between the cracks, and it shouldn't be, but it's, because, you know, you have, and this is, and again, this is what I guess what a group of us are trying to do is learn from each other. So, you know, it affects every bodily organ system. So, you know, I'll try and learn the lung stuff from people like Benita Kane and Asad Khan and Dave Joffe. And I'll try and learn as much of the brain stuff as I can from people like Danny Beckman. And there's a neurologist I work with who's great. You know, we're all learning off each other, because we're all single organ specialists, and that doesn't work when you've got post-viral disease at all. It just doesn't. You need to be a jack of all trades, and you need to understand enough about all of it to understand what it's doing. And if you can work out how to treat the underlying pathophysiology, you're going to treat more than one organ system. So that's kind of where we are. But do I think POTS is massively under-recognised? Massively underrecognized. And we've seen an explosion of POTS because, again, we know from the published research that at least, we think, 50% of individuals with long COVID will meet diagnostic criteria for POTS. But dysautonomia is more than just POTS. Dysautonomia itself is an umbrella term. So under the remit of autonomic dysfunction, you've got POTS, you've got IST, you've got orthostatic hypotension, you've got orthostatic hypertension, you've got neurocardiogenic syncope. You know, there's lots of different disorders within that. And we've had a massive explosion of it, and we weren't ready for it, because if according to the GP National GP Patient Survey, if you extrapolate out the data that was recently published and assume that long COVID rates are roughly equitable across the United Kingdom, then that suggests that about 3.1 to 3.2 million people in the UK have now got long COVID, but possibly more, because there was a group of individuals in the survey who weren't sure whether they had it or not. So, you know, even if 50% of them did and 50% didn't, it's possibly even higher than that. So obviously you will always get a bit of responder bias when you have surveys, but I don't know. It makes sense to me that the rates would be going up and up, because we're not doing anything to prevent it. So if you've got you know, 3.1 million people potentially with long COVID, you've got 1.5 million people probably with POTS, many of which have not been diagnosed. So yeah, I think it's a huge problem. And it's not difficult to diagnose, and it's actually not that difficult to treat. So yeah, we need more doctors doing it. Not just in the UK, everywhere.
It's a frustration, but it's also a potential positive that something that can impact quality of life so drastically does potentially have treatment for it. It's just not enough people are getting it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's quite a lot of different medications that can help with POTS. We don't have a cure, but there are quite a lot of medications that can help. And, you know, people do, and they just need the chance to, you know, just want to give people the chance to see if it helps.
Must be so thankful to you, Dr. Duncan. It really is working miracles in some ways. I've noticed that Aaron has made the time, extended it to 1 a.m. And I know it's probably getting close to bedtime on a school night for everyone in the UK, but if there was time for one last question, Living Ghost did have his hand up for a while. Would that be okay if we have one last question, Dr. Duncan?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, she kind of answered it, but I was going to ask, what percentage of people coming in with, palpitations and racing heart are showing damage from COVID, and like how many are like developing these chronic illnesses where the symptoms can't really be explained?
So the vast majority that I see with racing heart rates, it's dysautonomia rather than anything else. But again, and I'm not, you know, I can't stand up here and talk about my patients because obviously patient confidentiality, but if we go to talk about the research, what we know from the research is that, you know, there has been an increased association with other potential cardiac rhythm disorders after COVID. We do still sometimes see myocarditis after COVID, which is inflammation of the heart muscle. There has been since COVID started circulating in the kind of middle-aged group, we have seen a relative rise in heart attacks, strokes, and heart failure. So this is not a benign virus. It's not a benign virus. And there's lots of ways it can happen. You know, again, from the research point of view, it's been shown to, you know, we know it causes endothelial dysfunction. Endothelial dysfunction is a precursor to atherosclerosis, which is your cholesterol plaque disease and hardening of the arteries. And that happens silently over, you know, decades. And, you know, traditional risk factors are things like uncontrolled high blood pressure, smoking, diabetes, really strong family history, those kind of things. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I think COVID is most likely an independent risk factor for that as well. But we need more research to demonstrate it. But, you know, we tell people not to smoke, but we're not telling people not to go and get repeatedly reinfected with a virus that damages their blood vessels and the endothelium like smoking does. But other things, it does other things as well. So if you had microvascular disease, you can get microvascular angina, which is small blood vessels. It doesn't really show up that easily on a scan. You can get atypical chest pain with POTS as well, because I don't want to get too technical. It's probably too late to get too technical, because I could talk about this for hours and I'm not going to. But
I noticed that Aaron has extended the finishing time till 5 a.m., which I'm sure he's checked with you prior to Dr. Duncan.
I've got four kids that are going to have me up at 6:30 tomorrow morning. So I only popped on to say hi to Aaron for 10 minutes.
He's got you running across the countryside, and now he wants to staying up all night. I think he's a bad influence, to be honest.
So, but you know, they've isolated again in the research. They've isolated SARS-CoV-2 from foam cells. So, foam cells are lipid-laden macrophages that are involved in atherosclerotic plaques. So, there's quite a few potential mechanisms by how this virus is involved in accelerating cardiovascular disease. But look, this is not just COVID that can potentially do this. If we look back at history, I think I've talked about this before in another space somewhere. It might even be on this one. But if you look back at the Spanish flu back in, you know, the 2018 pandemic, and then you fast forward to the 1960s, there was a big study done in the 1960s looking at children that had lived through, had survived, had been infected and lived through the Spanish flu pandemic. And there was a massive spike in cardiovascular disease, you know, 30, 40 years on. And that would kind of fit, because atherosclerosis is a clinically silent condition that you get furring of the arteries. It happens over several years, even decades, before you then develop angina, heart attack, stroke. So I'm worried, and I've spoken about this publicly before, that, you know, we haven't even hit the peak of the cardiovascular disease we're going to see as a result of this.
And there's no real way of knowing that's going on until you get to the end stages of it, from what I understand. Like, you can't image your glycocalyx to see damage, for instance, or really understand how leaky the vasculature is.
I don't think that's entirely true. And one of the things that we would like to be able to do is to you can measure endothelial function. You can measure endothelial function, but you can only do it in research settings at the moment. So that's something that I would love to see change, because really, I think we need to be looking at prevention, even in people that haven't developed long COVID, even in people that have been infected. We don't know whether their endothelium's getting damaged or not. Well, actually, we do know from a very small study suggests that it might be. But these are very, very small numbers. We don't know if they translate across, you know, across populations. And anybody that's ignoring this, I think, is just, I think we're doing so at our peril, because this is, we don't want to be kicking the can down the road and just storing up even more chronic disease over the next few decades, because we're ignoring the problem right in front of us. So, If somebody gave me an unlimited budget and said, how would you fix long COVID? I could talk about this for hours, but I'm not going to. But we talked about this at the APPG, Benita and I. You know, we need to acknowledge and educate, because people need to understand what this virus is actually doing. And you can't fix a problem unless you understand what it is. You know, we need to prevent. We need to protect people. We need to investigate them with tests that actually show what we're looking at. So if we want to know whether this is causing endothelial damage, if we want to intervene at a really early stage before you get to the stage where you've got irreversible cardiovascular disease, you want to know early on. So you want to know whether you've got endothelial dysfunction. And there are some biomarkers, potential biomarkers, that could tell us that. There are some methods for analysing it using flow-mediated dilatation of the brachial artery, for example, with either echo or MRI. They're not perfect. There is a machine that uses a different way of measuring endothelial dysfunction using something called plethysmography, which is quite difficult to say at 1 a.m. when you're knackered. So, but they're all in the research setting. So it's about getting the funding to try and do big enough studies to try and say, is this going to be helpful? And then how we put that into clinical practice, because we have got loads of cardiovascular preventative medications that we're not using because we don't know who to use it on. And all drugs have got side effects, and it's not something that we should be doing.
And it's going to take a long time.
I know. And that's the problem. And people just don't have that time, which is why I really... And I know I keep banging on about it, but I really think if you look at how much COVID and long COVID and all the other other things COVID is doing in the chronic phase, like, you know, cardiovascular disease and neurological disease and, all, you know, endocrine disease and doubling the risk of diabetes and all of that. If you think how much that is costing the economy, because the people that are getting this, predominantly the highest levels are the economically active. So this is not the frail elderly, although anybody can get it, but this is our workforce we're disabling. We're not disabling, the virus is disabling. This is our workforce that's being disabled. And really, you need to kind of look at it from, it's a false economy not to try and prevent this and treat it better, because you're saying, you know, if you're saying we haven't got the money to do this up front, then what about all these people that are being knocked out of the economy, that are, that, you know, they can't support their families, they can't support themselves, you know, their employers are short-staffed, you know, the cost to the NHS. It's just, it doesn't make financial sense in my simple brain. Now, I'm not obviously not an economist, but I've got economists telling us it's costing the global economy about, you know, $1 trillion per annum. So maybe we should be using some of that money to try and prevent it costing $1 trillion per annum, and trying to fast track studies and research trials on a global scale to get on top of this, because COVID's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to go away.
The sad thing is, like so many things driven by scientific understanding first, often it takes until people are personally impacted or see the pattern in their own lives that before they start to move on things like this.
I know,
unfortunately, that'll be late for a lot of people.
I totally agree. And this is why there's been so many of us who do see what's happening behind closed, because this is the other thing. Long COVID is the pandemic behind the pandemic, and it's being played out behind closed doors, and loads of people are not seeing it. They just, you know, they maybe have not seen somebody for a while and they don't really understand why. And, oh, maybe they're just busy. Maybe they're just this, maybe they're just that. And loads of people, oh, I don't know anyone with long COVID. I bet you do.
Well, it's interesting. You've given me the perfect opportunity, Dr. Duncan, to segue into Aaron's own personal mission from God to raise awareness for long COVID, including billboards and all the other stuff he gets up to. But he is, we had the idea earlier on to host a space here for International Long COVID Awareness Day. And he's too shy to ask you, but I know he'd love if you were able to jump on at some point for a chat if you wanted to message him.
Yeah,
save you going just, halfway Aaron, across the country.
Me, Aaron, just send me a DM about the time, because I think there's a long COVID SOS are doing one as well for between 2 and 4 on the 15th. Because I got an invite for that, but if the time doesn't clash, just let me know. It just depends when I have 4 kids. Just whether I can get on and get the piece to get on.
Yeah, and I think I've kind of asked you for enough already, Dr. Duncan. Thanks, Jay, for that.
That's all right. It's no bother. Yeah, just drop me a DM, and if I can help, I'll try and do that, because, you know, I'm a big advocate for prevention, because I can't bear what I'm seeing.
If I could jump in and ask if you could get in the ear of Dr. Claire, of Dr. Taylor, you two have an amazing rapport on the space. It's great fun listening to you.
Yeah, we kind of bounce off each other a little bit. Yeah, she's actually a very good friend now. I didn't know her at all before we started doing all of this. So she's great.
I thought you two were thick as thieves. I thought you friends since college or something.
No, I didn't know Claire until we ended up, I don't even know how we met now, actually. I think it was through mutual friends that were working, you know, seeing patients in different parts of the country. So yeah, I didn't meet Claire until about 2021, I think. Yeah, you wouldn't know. You think we'd been mates for years. But yeah, I'll definitely mention her. Just send me some, drop me a DM, not tonight because it's too late, but just drop me a DM tomorrow once you've had a sleep, and I'll mention to Claire, and I'll mention to Benita as well.
Also, are you all right with me kind of leaving? I tend to kind of record my spaces. Is that kind of all right with you? Because I don't mind kind of taking it down. I imagine a lot of people over here. Anything
that involves talks about referrals to my clinic probably needs to come out, just because I don't want to get myself in trouble. So yeah, just, but the, you know, just general talk is fine.
All right, well, I'm kind of shattered here, and I bet you are too, but, I mean, does anyone kind of have, like, a last-minute kind of question for Dr. Duncan? Because otherwise I'm going to have to hit the hay and get my beauty sleep.
Well, I think I'm going to, I was about to say I'm going to join you, but I'm not going to join you in this.
Oh, my, it's too late for this.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we're going to delete the recording.
I came out a bit wrong. I'm going to go
that settled it in Aaron's mind.
Very tired.
Aaron's deleting the recording. That's that.
Yeah, you better delete that bit. All right.
I'm in trouble with his missus, Dr.
I'm gonna have to go to bed because I'm exhausted as well.
Thank you so much for jumping on the space today.
It's all right, it's no worries.
I always
chat to you. Oh, I've just seen Pete.
I always
didn't know Pete was in. Hello. Right, I'm going to jump off. Okay, it's nice talking to you all.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye, bye.